From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Hoping to remain in Congress and be eventually the chair of our Transportation and Infrastructure Committee to work in a bipartisan way to bring resources back to Illinois. But it's not my choice. It's the choice of the corrupt Democrats in Springfield.
Congressman Rodney Davis will not run for governor.
Top Republican officials had been courting him to jump into the race.
Congressman Rodney Davis will seek re-election to a sixth consecutive term on Capitol Hill, this time in a new district.
A Taylorville Republican says it was an easy decision.
Because it was always my first choice. My first preference was to run for re-election. Looking forward to helping Republicans take the majority back in the House.
Well, that's Congressman Rodney Davis. There was a lot of speculation that he would run for governor next year, but now he's decided to run for re-election in a newly drawn district. So where does that leave the Republican Party in Illinois as we head into a gubernatorial election in 2022? We'll talk about that and more coming up here on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. Also, we have Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois State House editor, and joining us today, Dave McKinney. He covers government and politics for WBEZ. And Dave, it's good to have you with us once again.
Good morning, Sean.
Well, let's start with it. Rodney Davis, we've talked about this several times on the show this year, wondering will he possibly jump into that race for governor? Well, he let the cat out of the bag this week, making his announcement he'll run for another term in Congress. And Hannah, of course, this is new territory, a newly drawn district that Democrats put together. Does that all clear things up when it comes to politics and what's going to happen in 2022, or does this just muddle the process a little bit more?
You know, I wouldn't say really either. I mean, I think it's been clear for a while that Davis wouldn't run for governor. It was just something that he was mulling. And, you know, as we got closer to Democrats actually passing the congressional map in late October, it became clear. So I'd say it's neither. We still have the same Republican field that we've had for many months now. And, you know, we still don't have a clear front runner who would be backed by, you know, the likes of Ken Griffin or Dick Ulin, you know, the conservative mega donors that have played such an outsized role in Republican politics here in Illinois. And so, you know, it is, like you mentioned, it's a brand new district. Basically, all of the 13th district that Davis has been representing since 2013, that was condensed and made into, you know, shored up into an even more Democratic district, safe for likely Nikki Budzinski, but former Pritzker advisor, Democrat running for Congress. She does have another Democratic opponent. I believe his name is David Palmer, but, you know, that was shored up, and now Rodney Davis has this kind of wonky looking district that surrounds that, goes all the way around, you know, from way western Illinois all the way to the Indiana border down to, you know, Terre Haute, and then it also then goes back southwest and it extends almost, you know, basically to the Metro East. So brand new territory, but he's not going to have any problem winning that and getting to know his new constituency who spent his life in politics. I think he'll be just fine.
And Hannah, isn't there also the possibility that another incumbent, first-term Congresswoman Mary Miller, she could possibly run in the same district against Davis? She's not said what she's going to do yet, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so Mary Miller, you know, she is the freshman, and she's also made some problems for the Illinois Republican Party, actually. I mean, so she is far right. And as we all remember, she, on January 5th, the day before the Capitol insurrection in D.C., she was out at a rally, and she said, she's giving a speech, and she said, Hitler was right about one thing, we have to win the hearts and minds of children. You know, invoking Hitler, never a great idea. It's caused some headaches, and so she has not been terribly popular, and she now has to decide whether to run against Mike Bost in his district, that's been extended all the way to east to Indiana, or she could run against Rodney Davis, cause problems for the both of them. But I don't think that she would necessarily beat either of them, or she could just retire.
Well, in that race for governor right now, Republican candidates who've announced include Darren Bailey, Paul Shimpf, Gary Rabine, and Jesse Sullivan. None of them are household names, at least at this point. And Dave, you're in Chicago. Rodney Davis, well, he's well known in central Illinois, a wide swath of central Illinois that he actually represents in Congress and has been in for a few terms now. I still don't think that he probably has that type of name ID across the state. So is this really a blow to Republicans if he's not in the race for governor?
Well, I mean, I think what Davis offered the party was an established candidate, somebody who sort of had predictable ideological standards. You know, like you knew that he was going to be a pro-business kind of guy. He was not a far, far, far right pro-Trump guy. I mean, he certainly has voted with Trump pretty much all of the time, but he was a bit of a contrast to somebody like Darren Bailey, the state senator from Xenia. Bailey has got a lot of energy downstate. All you have to do is drive around and you see yard signs for the guy everywhere. But I think for the party, what the real struggle is recapturing suburban Chicago, and particularly women in suburban Chicago. And I think there's a fear among party operatives that I've talked to that, like, Bailey's going to probably clean up downstate, but will he have any kind of appeal in the suburbs? Will any of these candidates have appeal in the suburbs? And that's where, Pritzker, he won all of the collar counties, except for, I believe, McHenry. And so it's kind of it's a dilemma the party faces here, particularly going into what a lot of, forecasters are saying could be a Republican wave year. We're still a year away, but still all signs point to a strong Republican turnout across the country. And Republicans here don't want to miss that, but it's a question of who do they have at the top of their ticket that's going to really kind of galvanize people. And I think back to 2014 with Bruce Rauner. I mean, he kind of fit the mold where, he was this business guy. He didn't have a deep kind of, he didn't have a voting record people could fixate on. So there were some unknowns about him. I mean, I think the perfect profile for a Republican candidate kind of fits that, a guy from the suburbs. So they're still kind of struggling to find out who they want to head the ticket. And not having Davis, limits their options a little bit on that front, I think.
Well, Dave, also, I believe Adam Kinzinger, he is not, I guess, completely ruled out the possibility he could run. Also, we've heard, the RTA chair, former state senator Kirk Dillard, his name got thrown about for a while. Are you hearing anybody else, any rumblings out there, especially now that Davis has taken himself out of that type of race?
Well, I mean, those are the names that are certainly out there. I think every single one of these people faces the same predicament, which is, where do they get money from? And will they have enough money to go head to head with the billionaire governor, J.B. Pritzker? And Ken Griffin, the hedge fund manager, billionaire, even more wealthy than Pritzker, has it out for Pritzker. He wants to take him out in this next election. But he hasn't really said who he's willing to commit his millions and millions and millions of campaign contributions to. So it's a bit of a beauty pageant right now, I think, for all of these people about, who is best suited to satisfy Ken Griffin primarily, because nobody else has that kind of money to go up against Pritzker at the moment.
Yeah, Charlie, former Governor Jim Edgar had mentioned a couple of times earlier in the year that Republicans need to find someone who's not going to scare away suburban voters, like Dave was talking about there. He says, they've got to somehow find someone that can appeal to the moderates. That is a challenge. It's been a challenge for Republicans.
Yes, and I think the difficulty is the Republican gubernatorial candidate is going to have to thread a very, very slender eye of a needle. He's got to be able, as Dave said, he's got to be able to do well in the suburbs to have any chance at all of winning. On the other hand, the kind of a moderate Republican who would do well in the suburbs may have a very difficult time getting out of a primary where the more right-wing elements of the party, the more conservative elements of the party, might find someone who is appealing to the suburbs as being very unattractive, and they may vote for somebody like Darren Bailey. Darren Bailey is very energetic. He's out there. He's being seen and heard. And he'll probably do very well downstate. But I would also point out that, unfortunately, downstate doesn't have the population anymore. So you could rack up winning, as a guess, you could win like 100 counties downstate and in the rural areas and still lose the race. There's also a problem for Republicans, and Jim Nolan had a column the other day mentioning this. If I'm not mistaken, the race at the top of the ticket is going to be for U.S. Senator, where Tammy Duckworth, an incumbent, is seeking re-election. And how are the Republicans going to find somebody who's able to successfully run against Tammy Duckworth, who is a legitimate war hero, who lost her legs, as we all know, in that attack on her helicopter in Iraq? You're going to be hard-pressed to find somebody who can do a credible job against her. And if you have some doofus as your gubernatorial candidate, the top two posts on the ticket are going to draw down or not really appeal to people to get them out to vote. And I'd also add that a Republican year nationally and a wave year does not necessarily translate into Illinois. There's been previous wave years nationally where the Democrats in Illinois, particularly for legislative races, have done quite well. And of course, as we said, there's a lot of time between now and the period in January when people start their petition circulating, and even longer before there's actually a primary in June. So there's a lot of time for other people to get involved. But as I see it now, I don't think the Republicans have a top tier candidate for either U.S. Senate or for governor.
Well, this week also, Darren Bailey got some attention, probably not for the right reasons. A Chicago man who has been part of his campaign was charged with storming the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Dave, can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, this is a guy who has been known, I think, to a lot of newsrooms in Chicago as an activist from the Logan Square area of Chicago on the northwest side. And he is accused of, disorderly conduct and being in the Capitol when he wasn't supposed to be. And he was arrested and charged a couple of days ago with that. And there've been at least 15 or 16 Illinoinans who are facing charges as a result of the insurrection. And what makes Ligas's case a little bit interesting is that, he has done a little bit of low-level campaign work for Darren Bailey. I mean, our colleague Rich Miller did a good job of pulling together a lot of the social media pieces out there. I mean, there was a fundraiser that Ligas held in Chicago, or was the contact for a fundraiser in Chicago for Bailey, and he's done field organizing work for Bailey. But the Bailey people say that he was not a formal piece of their campaign. He was, they said in their statement that they were shocked by the allegations against Ligas and that they don't condone illegal behavior. And the Democrats they were quick to pounce on the connection there and weren't completely satisfied with Bailey's response because they expected or hoped to hear more of a forceful kind of denunciation of what happened on January 6th from Bailey. And they believe that they haven't gotten that yet, or that voters haven't gotten that yet. And so it's a bit of a, optics problem, I think, for the Bailey campaign. I mean, I don't know that it's got a long shelf life, but I mean, if we get into a heated primary cycle where, opponents have money, there's a possibility that they could, an opponent could use that against him in a primary, but like Charlie mentioned, I mean, the base about when he talked about threading the needle, the base of Republican voters are, as they are across the country, are very aligned with former President Trump. And it could be a situation that might backfire if anybody in the primary field used that against Bailey. It might turn off Republican voters. I don't know. But it was a bit of a headache and surprise, I think, for Bailey still ahead of circulating petitions that he's having to deal with this.
And Hannah, this is definitely going to be in the news, though. The congressional committee that's investigating what happened on January 6th expected to have quite a number of hearings coming up. So that's going to be back in front of voters as we head into next year.
Right. I believe I saw a comment from Liz Cheney, who was on that January 6th commission, along with, of course, Adam Kinzinger, retiring congressman from Illinois 6th District. You know, apparently they're going to have, what'd she say, weeks of hearings. You know, we're approaching, obviously, that 1 year anniversary. And I do think that, I mean, this has been the longest year ever, following, of course, the other longest year ever. I think that, sure, voters are forgetting the visceral, you know, the things that they felt on that day. But for people in Washington, especially, of course, for the people who were actually in that building, people whose lives were very much in jeopardy, they're not soon forgetting it. And, you know, I think them bringing it to the forefront again, you know, we'll see where that goes. I don't know if that's going to cause any fatigue or, but, you know, whatever impact it might have, you know, they're going to do their best to keep reminding people of the very real danger that they're in and the very real danger that that represents to democracy writ large.
And earlier this week, Charlie, we had a case go before the U.S. Supreme Court getting a lot of attention, oral arguments held, and it's a case that has to do with abortion, and some people think it could lead to a rollback of Roe versus Wade and a lot of other abortion rights protections that are out there. That's the type of thing that is going to, no matter how people feel about the economy or Joe Biden, that's going to certainly elevate a certain group of people who want to come out and vote on that issue and probably get a lot of these more far left or even left leaning Democrats out to the polls, I would think.
Yeah, that's one of those issues where the polling suggests the majority of Americans basically want to leave things the way they are. And from kind of reading the tea leaves from what the justices, the kind of questions they were asking, the kind of statements they were making, this is the Supreme Court justices, it's pretty clear that Roe v. Wade, if not being totally thrown out, is going to be severely modified. And I think the bottom line is, it's ultimately going to be up to the states to do whatever they want to do in terms of regulating abortion. Illinois is one of the states, maybe the most receptive state to woman's right to choose. That won't change. I'm not sure it'll necessarily be a big issue in the election. For some people, it is the issue and the only issue. But I'm guessing the average Illinois voter is going to be more interested in what's happening with education, what's happening with healthcare, what's happening with state finances, what's happening with public safety, than they are whether or not a woman should choose to end a pregnancy.
Hannah, the courts still have a say when it comes to redistricting as well here in Illinois. There is a legal fight that is underway. We've talked about this before. Give us the update. Where do we stand heading into this weekend as far as what do we know is going to be happening with redistricting?
Well, finally, months and months and months after the redistricting process began back in, I don't know, March, we're finally going to, you know, the maps that Democrats passed not once, but twice, finally going to have their day in court, start Wednesday. Now, it's not the trial that I'd been imagining, honestly, but there's going to be either oral arguments or there's going to be you know, this panel of three federal judges is going to be reading a lot of documents over the weekend, deciding whether or not the legislative maps that Democrats passed will, you know, pass the smell test of the Voting Rights Act, you know, especially as it applies to Latino voters. And so this will end a very, very, very long process, I think. You know, by now everyone would be glad to have it out of the way and done, because of course we will start seeing filing petitions being circulated in early mid-January.
Well, Dave, you had an interesting interview this week with a man named Forrest Ashby, and that name might ring a bell to some people. It came up previously when it was mentioned in an email, but he had not spoken publicly until now. Fill us in on that email, the little bit of the backstory there, and what is he saying now?
Well, I mean, before you get into Forrest Ashby and who he is, you have to know who Mike McLean is. And most listeners on this show probably recognize McLean's name as the sort of the longtime consigliere of Michael Madigan. They served together in the Illinois House. McLean was a Democrat from Quincy and opened in the, I think, early 80s, what became one of the most successful lobbying shops in Springfield. He had a blue chip portfolio of lobbying clients, including Commonwealth Edison. And so when it became clear that McLean was on the radar for Commonwealth Edison, the Commonwealth Edison lobbying investigation, the bribery that they acknowledged, we started kind of poking around a little bit on McLean and his contacts. And we at WBEZ sent out an open records request to the governor's office in late 2019 to just sort of see what kind of emails were flying back and forth between McLean and the various chiefs of staff and various officials in the governor's office, dating back to back when Pat Quinn was governor. And we wound up getting this email that involved Ashby, who also comes from Quincy. And Ashby at the time was the head of a state facility in Rushville that housed repeat sexual offenders. They were civilly confined there. And he had run into some sort of disciplinary trouble where the agency, Department of Human Services, had some issue with him. It's not entirely clear what it all entailed. And so McLean wound up writing a letter to two top aides of Quinn that basically was trying to win leniency for Ashby in this disciplinary issue. And you read through the email, and at the very end of it, McLean talks about what a loyal guy this guy Ashby was to the Quinn administration, that he had kept his mouth shut, in quotes, about ghost workers. There was a reference to someone named Jones, and then also about a rape in Champaign. And so with that email, we wrote a story in January of 2020, and it shook Springfield. Like, what in the world is McLean talking about a rape in Champaign? And a colleague and I wound up corralling McLean outside of a steakhouse in Chicago to ask him about that. And he wouldn't respond to it. And we had a short time after that, we'd gotten an interview with Ashby, but it was an off the record interview, meaning that we couldn't air or publish any of the contents of it. And so we it's like a contract that we have in journalism that we honor that. And so we didn't learn until about a week ago that Ashby was now prepared to lift that lid, and he did that. And so the nature of the interview was just, he flat out denied covering up any sort of rape in Champaign. He didn't even know what McLean was talking about. And, you know, a longtime friendship between these two seems to have dissolved. Ashby is looking for answers from McLean about what in the world are you talking about? And Ashby spoke about what kind of toll this has taken on him in Quincy, in a small town where everybody knows one another usually. And people think that he covered up ghost payrolling and a rape. And he said neither of which was true. So that was really kind of the grist in the interview that came out. And we checked back with McLean, and McLean again, who was awaiting trial on a series of conspiracy and bribery charges, wouldn't say anything at all about what Ashby had to say.
And time now for our notes from the field. Hannah, let's start with you.
Well, sure. We had two announcements of retirements from the General Assembly this week. Dave will handle the other one, but Springfield's own Mike Murphy, a Republican who served for the last 3 years, locally known as the one-time owner of Charlie Parker's Diner. He resigned from his seat in the House on, I think it's Tuesday night, and not unexpected. He's kind of a casualty of the Democratic map-making process. He was redistricted into a new district with Representative Avery Bourne, who's kind of a rising star of the Republican Party. And so, we knew that he was gonna resign. His new job is leading the Greater Springfield Chamber of Commerce, and he was very jazzed about it when we chatted this week.
Okay. Dave?
This week also brought the announcement that House Majority Leader Greg Harris from the north side of Chicago is planning planning for this to be his final year in Springfield. Many listeners will remember Harris as being really kind of the main architect of the state's law that legalized gay marriage. And he really got that over the goal line. And it took a great deal of work to finalize that and get it over with. And I talked to him after he made his announcement. And he talks about how people to this day will come up to him in the grocery store. It might be a gay person. It might be their parent. It might be a friend who just, said this really changed a lot of lives. You know, he's one of those legislators who managed to navigate through a lot of stuff. I mean, he was a budget point person for Speaker Madigan in his majority leader role. He navigated through a lot of stuff without the taint or even hint of any kind of corruption. And so Harris, I think, is going to be missed in Springfield because he was a real stabilizing and civil voice who really kind of knew how government worked.
Okay. And Charlie?
Well, as we are recording this show, it is Friday morning, the 3rd of December in the year 2021, and it is the 203rd birthday of the state of Illinois. So happy birthday, Land of Lincoln. Dave mentioned how Greg Harris had no taint of corruption about him, which is absolutely 100% true. But oftentimes the notion of corruption kind of focuses on the city of Chicago, the Democratic machine. But I think an interesting little side note to the fact that this is Illinois' birthday is that when Congress passed the legislation to provide for statehood, they made a couple of changes at the behest of Nathaniel Pope, who was the territorial delegate. One was they reduced the population from the 60,000 required to 40,000. The other one was that they extended the northern boundary of Illinois 41 miles north of the southern tip of Lake Michigan. And so we got those changes made. And we also volunteered to do the census ourselves rather than have the federal government go to the trouble of sending people way out into the wilderness to count people in Illinois. Interesting thing, and I'm going to quote here from the late Bob Howard's great History of Illinois, Illinois History of the Prairie State. Illinois was far short of the required 40,000 when the deadline occurred, so we extended the deadline. Ultimately, we managed to turn in a count of 40,258. And part of it was we counted some settlers two or three times. We listed some families repeatedly as they crossed the state on the way to Missouri. So if you came into town to buy something today, you were counted. If you came into town to buy something tomorrow, you'd be counted again. And the best estimate was at the time we had roughly 35,000 residents, but Congress accepted our 40,258 number and Illinois became a state, the 21st state of the Union.
Okay, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. And our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Anna Meisel, and WBEZ's Dave McKinney. You can get a podcast of our show by going to nprillinois.org. Also, you can find our podcast through the NPR One app and iTunes. Just look for State Week and join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.